This is the BBC.
Hello, I'm Kirsty Young. Welcome to Desert Island Discs, where every week I ask my guests to choose the 8 tracks, the book and the luxury item that they'd want to take with them if they were cast away on a desert island. For rights reasons, the music on these podcast versions is shorter than in the original broadcast. You can find over 2,000 more editions to listen to and download on the Desert Island Discs website. My castaway this week is the journalist and author Christina Lamb. Over the past 3 decades, she has travelled the world reporting from the Amazon to Zimbabwe. But it's her first-hand accounts of the turmoil in the Middle East that have secured her reputation as a first-class war reporter. Whether dodging bullets in Helmand or having clandestine meetings with Taliban chiefs in the back streets of Quetta, her nose for a story has repeatedly led her into perilous territory. She seems to like it. The cobalt blue mosques and sweet grapes of Kandahar are something of a contrast to the suburban England of her comfortable 1970s childhood, where she rebelled against the starchy uniformity of her grammar school and dreamt of a life of adventure beyond Croydon. She has, she says, navigated through roadblocks manned by red-eyed, drug-crazed boys with Kalashnikovs in West Africa, been abducted in the middle of the night by Pakistani intelligence, and come under sniper fire in Iraq. All around me, she says, people have died. My life, I believe, is charmed. And that strikes me, Christina Lamb, as quite a dangerous thing to think, that your life has been charmed. Well, explain it to me.
I suppose, I mean, listening to that, it does sound like a dangerous thing to say. I guess doing this kind of job, you have lots of narrow escapes, and that you feel that luck plays a part of your survival, and I've had far more than my 9 lives by now.
You've been a foreign correspondent for nearly, 30 years now?
Yes.
And it's clear you've been in some of the world's most dangerous places. I mean, I mentioned about going to see Taliban warlords, essentially. What do you do to protect your own safety when you're in a set of circumstances like that?
Well, I mean, first of all, the job has changed enormously. When I started out, if anything happened to you, it was more bad luck or you'd done something silly or car crashes. Now it's totally different. We are targets and that makes it much harder. I'm a great believer in, you know, having personal contact. I've gone back to the same places again and again, Afghanistan in particular. So there are people that I trust there. But even that has become difficult. I've had colleagues whose long-time trusted contacts and fixers have betrayed them.
You are steeped not just in the culture, but in the history of the places that you cover. How do you make these complex stories approachable for us? How do you get your readers engaged in what is, you know, often a very difficult thing to understand?
I've always wanted to be a storyteller. I wanted to write novels. I ended up working as a journalist and telling other people's stories. And if you can tell one person's story powerfully, it seems to me that that is the best way to engage people.
Tell me then, Christina Lamb, what we're going to hear first today.
So the first piece of music from Der Rosenkavalier takes me back to a time when I spent a year at Harvard. I was on a fellowship where you could take any course that you like. I found a course called Introduction to Opera. One of the operas that we studied was Der Rosenkavalier. Also in that hall was one of the other fellows who was Portuguese, and we ended up getting married. So it's a special piece to me.
Thank you. I Made a Vow from Rosen Cavalier, composed by Richard Strauss, sung there by Agnes Balzer, Anna Tomova-Sietnoff and Janet Perry, with the Vienna Philharmonic, conducted by Herbert von Karajan. Christina Lam, wars and conflict zones then have been the main focus of your work throughout the decades, and you have talked about and written about the idea that women are the real heroes of war. What have you seen on the ground that has led you to that conclusion?
I actually get hope and inspiration from what I see women doing in these difficult situations. For example, in Aleppo, I was there when Aleppo was under siege, and women were doing remarkable things to try and feed and protect their children. All they had was flour, and they were growing little herbs in what areas they could find to do that. And so they were frying these flour sandwiches and ripping down window frames and doors to be able to have firewood to keep their children warm. Of course, there are places I go to that are very misogynistic and can't believe that you're really a journalist for a serious newspaper. But I think as a woman, I'm able to talk to anybody, whereas my male colleagues can't go and speak to the women behind the purdah curtains. And so that's a very important part of the story that they're not getting.
You're chief foreign correspondent for the Sunday Times now. In your many decades doing the jobs in different roles, have you worked under any female foreign editors?
Shockingly, I mean, I would never have imagined I'd be saying this when I started out at 21, that in 30 years I have never had a female foreign editor. At the Sunday Times, the magazine is edited by a woman, and that's great, and she's a passionate supporter of women.
Let's have some more music, Christina Lam. Tell me what this is and tell me why you've chosen it today.
So this is What a Wonderful World by Louis Armstrong. It brings back a particular occasion, which was when I was in Afghanistan in 1988. I'd gone there with a group of fighters and with Hamid Karzai, who later became very well known. We went on an attack on Kandahar Airport, which was a very bad idea because Kandahar Airport was controlled by the Russians. And the fighters launched this attack. Immediately, tanks came down the hill and started firing, killed some of the fighters that I was with. The rest of us were in this trench, and we were stuck there overnight, and we had nothing to eat. There were just muddy puddles with crabs in, which the Mujahideen ate. I did not. Eventually, the next afternoon, the tanks went and we could leave. And there was a little boy eating a watermelon, and I have never wanted anything more in my life than that watermelon. I was so hungry and thirsty. So to my shame, I said to the leader of our group, I really want that watermelon. And he took it from the boy. Now everyone's going to hate me. And then we went to the house we were staying in. And I carried very few things in those days, but I used to carry a shortwave radio. And I put it on and this music was playing.
I see skies of blue and clouds of white. The bright, blessed day, the dark, sacred night. And I think to myself, what a wonderful world. The colors of the rainbow, so pretty in the sky, are also on the faces.
Louis Armstrong with Wonderful World. Christina Lam, you are the only daughter of Anne and Ken. Tell me about your childhood.
I grew up in Morden, the southernmost stop of the Northern Line. And then we moved when I was, I guess, 9 or 10 to a place called Carshalton Beaches. And I always wanted to be somewhere else, really. Where I'd grown up when I was little was an area where people were always in and out of each other's houses. So I didn't really feel like an only child. And then when we moved to Carshalton Beaches, it was a place where people sort of made appointments to have tea with each other.
Right.
And I found that very odd. It's commuter land. Everybody goes off every morning to work in the city.
And why had you moved there?
I think for schooling, because it was one of the few places that still had state grammar schools.
Right. You've written a lot of books, of course, and you write beautifully. When did they begin to be important to you?
Oh, God, all my life. We always used to go to the library on Saturdays. And then when we lived in Kashuan Beaches, a mobile library used to come, I think, twice a week. So I read voraciously. My mum used to get cross because I'd be reading at night, you know, with a torch. I read everything. I mean, my dad used to read Dennis Wheatley books, and so I read those. I read historical fiction. I was fascinated by stories about explorers.
Really? And where did you go on holiday?
When I was a teenager, we went on package holidays to Italy and Spain. My dad always used to write off to the local tourist office. This was the days before internet. So these big brown envelopes would arrive with all these leaflets and all these places with palm trees and sunshine. And I loved it. I loved Italy. Everything was different to my life in South London.
Let's have some more music, Christina Lamb. We're going to listen now to your third choice. Tell me a bit about this.
Okay, so this is a song I don't particularly like.
Right.
Called Only When I Sleep from The Corrs. No offence to The Corrs. One of the places that I've gone to a lot is Zimbabwe. I've reported endlessly on all the terrible things that Mugabe has done to his people. And going there was quite difficult because British journalists were banned. So we would have to go there undercover. We went in all sorts of guises. And when we were trying to expose the rape camps, we had to go through a lot of checkpoints. And you fear that you're going to get caught at each one. We only had one tape with us, and it was the Corrs' Talk on Corners. So the first time we came to checkpoint, and there were all these thugs there stopping us, we had this music playing. So then they kind of started chatting to us and asking about the music. So every time we came to a checkpoint, we would put Only When I Sleep on. And it worked. We never got stopped. We got through all the checkpoints.
That was The Corrs and Only When I Sleep. Christina Lamb, everything I read leads me to believe you were quite a naughty schoolgirl.
I think all journalists perhaps are naturally rebellious. Yeah, I was always in trouble at high school. I did silly things, really. I did things like putting plastic ducks on the school ponds. My close friend Julie pretended to be my German exchange student and kind of created havoc in my classes. I set up a school drama group. And we used to produce these Monty Python plays every morning for school assembly, which were very irreverent. So my group was banned.
And you got into Oxford. You must have had very good results.
I got into Oxford, which was lucky because actually I had been suspended from school by that time. And I didn't want to go back. My mother couldn't really understand what happened because when I told her what had happened, she couldn't believe that these small things would lead to such punishments. So she insisted on seeing the headmistress. But by that time, I then had this offer for Oxford, for an unconditional offer. I just had to get 2 E's. The school very rarely got people into Oxbridge. So they, at that point, really wanted to keep me. So they then wanted me to come back. And I ended up going back, but I was very unhappy about it.
Let's have some more music, Christina Lamb. We're going to hear your fourth.
So my fourth song is Gold from Spandau Ballet. I love this song. And this just so takes me back to the 80s. Music was kind of my life, really, when I was a teenager. I used to go to concerts all the time, punk, mods, new romantics. I used to wear the sort of frilly, long-sleeved shirts and lacy collars, and I had that big hair. I remember playing it at my 80th birthday party, and I had my place at Oxford then, and it takes me back to a time where I sort of felt life was about to change. Gold, always believe in your soul.
was Spandau Ballet and Gold, You and Me loving every bit of that, Christina Lamb. While you were at Oxford, you edited the university newspaper, and once you left, you worked as an intern at the Financial Times,
yeah.
Is that right? And you, while you were at the FT, you attended this lunch instead of somebody else from the paper. You were sort of put in as a placeman, and you sat next to the Secretary General of the Pakistan People's Party, as it happened, and that was how you came to be given the opportunity to interview Benazir Bhutto. What were your first impressions of her, the first time that you met her? Because this was a relationship that would last for many years.
Well, the first time I met her was the day that she announced her engagement to Asif Ali Zardari. So her flat in London was absolutely full of bouquets of flowers. I'd never seen so many flowers or such beautiful bouquets. She was very eloquent and very charming. She was the bravest person I had ever met. And she was doing amazing things on one hand. But, you know, when she became prime minister, actually, she didn't do a lot of the things that she had promised.
You must have impressed Benazir Bhutto, because she invited you to her wedding in Karachi. It lasted a week to 10 days. It was a very opulent event. And at the end of the day, people would be discussing how politics should be part of the common man's experience and so on. And for you, it was a pivotal moment. You decided that you wanted to stay there. You struck a deal with the FT. The deal was that they'd rent you a word processor and they'd pay you for anything that they'd published. You were, I mean, what, you were only 21. This is a bit of a rude question, but how on earth did you persuade them that you had the knowledge to be a foreign correspondent and you were able to write with any authority?
I'm not sure, really. I mean, looking back, you know, the foreign editor, Yorick Martin, trusted me and I was going in and out of Afghanistan. And at that time, really writing quite different things to what was the sort of accepted wisdom. I think, you know, I was very naive. I'd never been a correspondent. I didn't know what correspondents did. And so I just wrote what I saw. And so I was kind of shocked, really, by that. And I've tried never to lose that. I don't think you should ever go into a place and think this is what the story is before, that you should always, you know, go there and see what's actually happening on the ground.
Let's have some more music, Christina Lamb. We're going to go to your fifth. Why have you chosen this?
This reminds me of a very happy time in my life. So this is Tom Jobim singing El Seyed Kavochama, I Know That I Will Love You. After I came back from Pakistan and Afghanistan, the foreign editor of the FT called me in and said, how about going to South America? So I'd never been to South America in my life. I ended up going to Brazil and our office was in Rio. I just thought, this is the most beautiful place I have ever seen in my life. And one of the first nights there, I went to a famous bar called Garota de Ipanema, a girl from Ipanema, where this song was written. And I was lucky enough to go and see Tom Jobim live. And he used to play with a glass of whiskey and a cigarette hanging out of his mouth. He had this wonderful voice. So it takes me back to that time, being kind of 25 in Brazil. I had a great apartment overlooking the sea. I danced in carnival and I just loved everything about it.
Eu sei que vou te amar por toda a minha vida. Eu vou te amar a cada despedida. Eu vou te amar desesperadamente. Eu sei que vou te amar, e cada verso meu será.
That was Tom Jobim singing I Know. Roughly translated, it means I know that I will love you. Is that right, Christine Lamb?
Which is what I sort of felt about Rio, I think.
You were talking before that last piece of music about being in Afghanistan. By 1989, everybody was leaving. The Americans were leaving, all the journalists were leaving. You were not. Shortly after everybody had left, there was the Battle of Jalalabad, which you have written about extremely powerfully. And it was a fierce and appalling fight. Just briefly, how many people died during that fight?
10,000 people in 1 week. It was a massive number.
You were right in the middle of the horror. And there's a moment that you have written about where you were mistaken for a medic. By a woman. Can you describe that moment to me?
Why so many people were killed was because the Mujahideen were firing rockets into the city and people were fleeing the city. but the Afghan Air Force, which may still have been Soviet-backed, were bombing the people as they fled. It was just like a massacre. I'd never seen so much killing. So I was there in the midst of all this and, you know, shocked and trying to take it all in. And then people saw me and were rushing to me, asking for help and wanting, thinking that I was a nurse that had come to help them. And I felt very inadequate because I couldn't really do anything. I didn't know any first aid. Actually, I at one point ended up stitching somebody, despite not having a clue how to do it. And I didn't, it's not like now where we travel with medical kits and things. I mean, I didn't carry anything with me. I didn't even have a plaster.
The idea that journalists and photographers and camera people are there simply to tell the story and not get involved must be almost impossible when you are actually there seeing it and people are asking you for help. What did you make of your own response at the time to take your notebook and your pen and get on the truck and leave?
Yeah, I felt wrong and inadequate. I wanted to help. I also think if you're in a position to save someone's life, you should do it. You know, whatever you think you're there, your job is for. Unfortunately, I didn't know how to do it.
We're going to hear your sixth piece of music now, Christina. What have you chosen?
So I've chosen Elvis Costello's She. I am also a mum, and this music reminds me of when I was giving birth. I actually have a son, so it seems odd having a song called She, and he'll be cross listening to this. But my son was actually born very early. He was born at 28 and a half weeks, so it was very frightening. And I was having a cesarean. There were two doctors, and they were playing Magic FM and talking about their commute into work. And it seemed so incongruous to me because this was my child being born. Then, as my son was delivered, this is the song that was being played. And it was a great relief because they'd warned me all sorts of things. They said it would be a very good sign if he cried. And there was a little cry as he was born.
She always seems so happy in a crowd, whose eyes can be so bright and so proud. No one's allowed to see them when they cry. She may be the love that cannot hope to last, may come to me from shadows of the past that I remember till the day I die. She may be the reason I survive.
Elvis Costello with She, and that was being played as your son Lorenzo was born. That was in 1999,
yes.
I think. He would have been about 7 or 8 years old by the time that you were back in Pakistan in 2007. You'd been travelling on the actual bus that Benazir Bhutto was travelling on as she was campaigning. The bus was blown up. 140 supporters outside the bus were killed. Three people inside the bus were killed. You survived, as did Benazir Bhutto. You had called your son and your husband before to say they're covering this on TV. You should watch.
Yeah, hey, mummy's on the bus, have a look. Yeah, all of a sudden there was this boom and we were all thrown to the ground, and then there was a much bigger blast. Everything seemed to be on fire all around us, and music stopped, and you could hear screams and then sirens. And I realised quickly that, you know, I was fine, but there were three people who were clearly dead on the top of the bus. And then I was really worried that the bus would catch fire, the petrol tank, so screaming to people, get off the bus. I mean, so we got off and then ran, and you could just see everywhere there was people, limbs blown off and shoes, and I ran down a side street and a woman stopped me and said, "Are you all right?" And I said, "Yeah, I'm fine." And then I realised it was covered in blood, and it was other people's blood from people who'd been killed.
How long was it before you were able to call home and to reassure them?
Well, I mean, the first thing I wanted to do was call, because I was really worried that that my family would be watching, because it was about 7 o'clock in the UK. So I know that they watch the Channel 4 news. So I was desperate to call, but the phone had died hours before. But fortunately, a man then came out of his house and took me in. And then I was able to call and tell them that I was okay.
What do you think the lasting effect upon you is of being not just in that extraordinary and appalling set of circumstances, but the other situations that we've briefly touched on today?
The hardest thing often is coming back. It can be quite hard to deal with normal life. And I mean, in some ways, being a mum was actually very grounding, because, you know, some correspondents come back and hang out in bars telling war stories.
Indeed they do. I'm wondering that you might make a terrible friend. But if people say, we're looking forward to seeing you at dinner on Tuesday night, and you have to go.
Yes. Yeah, I buy theatre tickets and almost never can go. I miss weddings, birthdays, anniversaries. That's awful, it's true.
Let's have some more music, Christina Lamb. We're going to listen to your seventh.
This is Mozart's clarinet concerto in A major, and this was the soundtrack of Out of Africa. And I chose this because I was working on a book called The Africa House. It was about an English man called Sir Stuart Gore Brown, who'd built this English country mansion by a lake of crocodiles in a remote part of what was then Northern Rhodesia, but now Zambia. And he had a gramophone there and had this piece of music. The house had been abandoned quite some time before. So every time I opened up one of the trunks of papers, these huge spiders would come out. And this is one of my secrets as a war correspondent. I'm supposed to be brave and fearless, but I'm scared of spiders.
That was part of Mozart's clarinet concerto in A major from the soundtrack to the film Out of Africa. The soloist there was Jack Brymer, and he was accompanied by the Academy of St Martin in the Fields, conducted by Neville Mariner. Given the digital technology that we now all have access to, Christina Lamb, do you think, I mean, we're all citizen journalists now, aren't we, if we choose to be. Do you think the days of the fleck-jacketed foreign correspondent who tells us the truths of foreign lands is pretty much on its way out?
No, I don't. I think, of course, I would say that because I am one. But, you know, I think it's great that you can get information from anybody, anywhere, and there are lots of people telling their own stories. But I do still think it's important to have someone that you'd have been covering this story for a long while and that can put things in context and sort through all this mass of information in this time of sort of, you know, fake news. You know, facts are facts. You can't have alternative facts. That's why it's important to be there and actually, you know, report on what's happening. The problem is that, of course, newspapers are in financial crisis and we've all cut back a lot. And also there's so many wars going on and we don't seem to know how to bring them to an end. And that's also frustrating because you go and report on all these things and we still seem to make the same mistakes. So you do feel a bit like, doesn't anybody read any of the things that we write?
But it's interesting that, I mean, for example, in 2006, a report of yours from Helmand led to a parliamentary debate, and that increased as a result the amount of helicopters, the resources for troops in Afghanistan. That must surely have felt like a small but pretty important victory.
Yeah, I mean, there's a whole question about whether we should ever have been in Helmand. But if we were going to send troops there, we needed them to be properly equipped.
Looking back to when you first started, you know, sitting there in Peshawar with your little Tandy computer and freelancing, you were a real self-starter. Do you think it would be possible for a young man or woman these days to begin it the way you did?
Well, in some ways, I think it's easier because my biggest problem was getting the stories back. I remember the night General Zia was killed in the air crash, and it was those old Bakelite phones where you're dialing again and again. It probably took me an hour to get through to the operator. So in some ways, now people can email. I can send a story from anywhere, from the top of a mountain in the Hindu Kush, from the middle of the desert. So that part is a lot easier.
There are very few people that are cast away who I think would survive more than a couple of weeks. I'm reckoning you'd be one of the people who would survive. Incredibly resourceful, very resilient, not scared of much. Am I right?
In some ways, I dream of going somewhere really quiet and just being able to write my novel. But I think I would miss people.
Let's hear your final piece of music then, Christina Lamb. What's it going to be?
This is always Look on the Bright Side, Monty Python's Life of Brian. Monty Python was sort of what kept me going as a teenager. I loved Monty Python's sketches. In fact, even when I got to Oxford, although I was excited to be there, I felt very insecure. No one in my family had been to university. Everybody there seemed to know everything about what to do. I didn't know, you know, what plate you were supposed to put your bread on, what knives and forks to use at the dinner. It was intimidating. And my mum had bought me one of the Monty Python collections of scripts when she left me at Oxford. So I remember reading the sketches to myself.
Some things in life are bad. They can really make you mad. Other things just make you swear and curse. When you're chewing on life's gristle, don't grumble, give a whistle. And this'll help things turn out for the best. And always look on the bright side of life. Always look on the light side of life.
Always Look on the Bright Side of Life, sung there by Eric Idle, and it was featured in the film Monty Python's Life of Brian. It's time now, Christina, for me to give you some books. You get the Bible, you get the complete works of Shakespeare, and you're going to take what along with them?
So I'm a big Hemingway fan, so I would take Hemingway's For Whom the Bell Tolls.
It's yours, and you're allowed a little luxury, or indeed a big one. What would you like?
Not very original, but I am a writer, and if I had lots of time, I would love to write a novel. So paper and pencils.
Certainly, you may have those. And if you had to save just one of these 8 discs that you've chosen for us today, which one would it be?
Always look on the bright side. It's sort of my motto, I think, in all these horrible places I go to.
It's yours. Christina Lamb, thank you very much for letting us hear your Desert Island discs.
Thank you.
I hope you enjoyed this edition of Desert Island Discs. You'll find over 2,000 interviews with artists, musicians, scientists, sports stars, comedians and more at bbc.co.uk/Desert Island Discs. And I have a favour to ask. If you could rate and review the Desert Island Discs podcast wherever you download your podcasts, it'll really help other people find us. Thanks again for listening.
This is the BBC.
Oh, hey, fancy meeting you here. I'm Sindhu V, and if you enjoyed that, why not let Radio 4's Comedy of the Week podcast into your feed? I host the podcast, and here's what happens. I bring you comedy fresh out of Radio 4's Funny Factory. Sometimes I bring you interviews with writers and performers, and a little bit of my take on the world and what's going on. Just search for Comedy of the Week on your favorite podcast app, subscribe, and it'll be available for you every Monday morning.